Is this the reading room?
Yes, I'm Dr. Saad Manzoor.
And I'm Dr. Travis Howard.
This is Reading Room Talk. Thank you for pressing play. Appreciate you guys being here with us.
Absolutely. Thank you. Welcome.
Yes, yes. We have the most specialist of guests today. We have Dr. Janice Newsom here. How are you today?
Hey, hey. Usually doing my greeting. Hello, hello.
Excellent.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Yes. Thank you so much for being here with us. We have so many questions for you. Can't wait to get into your whole story, but we're going to start in medical school. Can you tell us?
Wow. So long ago, guys. Me, really, in medical school.
Last year? When was that? Like last couple years
ago? Yeah, a couple decades
ago. Oh, sorry. Well, take us back to that time. What would you say was your toughest class or rotation in medical school?
Yeah, so in medical school, I would say that the toughest years were like the, you know, pre-rounding, pre-clinical years, because I really just struggled with organic chemistry and trying to figure out, you know, how did these things really have anything to do with some of my life? I did a six-year BSMD program. Nice. Out of New York City, so I didn't have a traditional pathway. I went, you know, those were kind of integrated. And so, I would have to say that those were my toughest years. But even in the, on the ward years, one of my toughest rotations was actually in psychiatry. And you know, that's surprising,
really?
Given that I tell people that one of my superpowers is caring. So I was really looking for that, but it turns out that I stretched the extent of that on the psychiatry rotation. I just didn't my younger self did not connect very well on that rotation, and it showed. And so that those were not the best grades in my medical school years.
Interesting. That can happen. I mean, you know, like sometimes it's the rotation that you're like not prepared for that's going to come and like, you know, take advantage of you. So that's very interesting.
I'm telling you, brother, I can share a story. You know, I remember I did my medical school at Mount Sinai in New York, and one day I ran to the ER. I interviewed this patient. It was like perfect. I thought it was great. Went back to my attendant to talk about it, and he said, well, did you notice anything about this patient? I'm like, no, not at all. I started telling her all about the things that I thought was happening, probably just thinking too much. And then she's like, could you go back downstairs? And I want you to go ahead and ask Miss Y, you know, what exactly is going on with her makeup? And I didn't even notice that patient was wearing makeup, you know. And when I got there was like a total different side of her face. Like she had like one side made up a different way, the other side. And so I'm like, oh, tell me about your makeup. And then that's when the whole psychosis came out, you know, which is the, you know, I communicate with the gods of Venus from one side and with the gods of Mars on the other side. But, you know, New York City. And I'm used to just differences and different lifestyle. You know, I just accepted that was just the way that she was, you know, that she wanted to look, right?
Yeah, it was just her look, exactly.
It's just her look, right? So I would tell you that, man, that was like a huge blow to my head. And then the same thing, this over-acceptance can be in trouble. It can get you in trouble at times, you know, like I would go on the rounds and say people would be just hearing songs in their heads, and I'm like, yeah, I hear that song too. Yeah, but of course, that's not the right thing to say.
But you want to connect, though. You want to connect.
But you can see how trying, exactly, this overreaching, overconnecting can be problematic. I've learned my lessons. How about that?
It's all good. I think that's, you know, it can happen. It can definitely happen. So I also think that, like, again, like, it kind of gives you, like, after doing, like, second year and third year, or, like, you know, first and second year, and just doing, like, all the, you know, science classes and everything, just, like, actually having to talk to people, it's something you have to, like, retrain yourself to do and do it in a special way. So,
it's
tough. And also, big shout out to you. So you did a program straight out of high school into medical school.
Yeah, I did. You know, it's a 7-year BSMD program now called the Sophie Davis School for Biomedical Engineering. Mm-hmm. It's out of Harlem, USA, City College of New York. Predominantly, you know, designed to capture the diamonds in the rough, people that are would not necessarily have gotten that opportunity. I applied to the program. It was, you know, kind of sold as for gifted students only. But, you know, like no one told me I was gifted, but, you know, I came here from Jamaica.
Yes.
I was really behind in my studies. I didn't quite match up.
Now, how old were you when you came from Jamaica?
I was a teenager, so, you know, mid to high teens.
Okay.
And you know, I just thought that I was really behind. So I was, you know, about to prove and to try to catch up. So when I was given an opportunity to apply to the program from my guidance counselor mm-hmm. in high school, I applied knowing that I may not even get in. But, like, what did I have to lose
exactly,
more than a no, right?
You give it a try. You should always give it a try.
You should always give it a try. And that's, like, the first thing I would tell you. But, you know, just... You know, you are special to somebody. You're gifted and you just don't even know it. And if I didn't have a guidance counselor to say, you can definitely do this program. We've never had anybody from our school ever get in.
Mm-hmm.
You do your first year of college in high school.
They believed in you.
Yeah, you got that right. So it's that first thing of believing in you. And it was not easy. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, it's not like, I've heard those programs are basically like you do your whole 4 years of undergrad in like 2 years, basically.
Yep,
That's intense.
You know, no summers at all. You just go to school all year round. But you know what it does? It gets you out of trouble. What are you gonna do?
That's true. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So, wow, that's great though. I mean, I think like you know, a lot of people dream of getting into these programs. I know a lot of parents dream about getting their kids into these programs. So, how did your family react when you were able to get into such an exclusive program?
I don't think my family knew anything about the exclusivity of this program. You know how our families are. It's like, okay, are you going to go to church tonight? Unlike the choir is going out to sing. Are you going to make it?
Yeah.
You know?
Right. That's most important over everything. Are you going to be at church the next day?
Exactly. I mean, it wasn't any, oh, you are in a part of this exclusive program or not. I know that I graduated from that exclusive program and thought I was going to go into surgery. I didn't want to. I did surgery.
Okay.
And I called my family back home and some of my family here, and they were like, man, Doc, I thought that you were doing well in school.
What?
I'm like, yeah, that's why I matched for surgery, you know. But, you know, back home and not so exclusive to Jamaica, but in other places, like, you know, like my papa was a shoemaker, right? So he grew up doing that trade, and he just thought that surgery was just like sewing people up like he sewed shoes or a dressmaker.
That's so funny.
Wow.
The smartest people don't go into surgery. The smartest people figure out what's wrong with patients.
That's so interesting. That perspective is different, yeah.
Totally different perspective. And so I had to teach him and my mama and my auntie and my cousin and my sister. You know, that in America, the toughest thing that you could do was, at the time, is to be a surgeon.
Exactly. I'm actually killing the game.
Change the game, you know, that. But there, the toughest thing that you could do was, you know, be an internal medicine doctor, right? Not this people that sew people up.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And I think also that, you know, like, it sounds like you didn't have family that was in medicine, so they couldn't appreciate how tough that was for you to get into surgery. So,
that's correct.
Yeah, because I think like in our, you know, like in my culture, I'm from the Sudan, and like, you know, surgeons are like, you know, top of the food chain. So like when, you know, when I told them I was going into radiology, they're like, you're just going to take x-rays?
Yeah.
I hear that still right now, you know.
Right. My dad says the same thing. You don't want to be a surgeon. Well, why not? If you can be, you should be. They're like the top dog.
Exactly. It's the perspective is funny in different places. Yeah, it's definitely different. But it sounds like in the end, you have to do what you want to do and like what you're like, you know, going to be able to do. So you sounds like you did surgery for a little bit and then decided against it.
Not really. It's you know, wish I would say that I sat there and decided, oh, I want to be a surgeon or I want to not be a surgeon. Mm-hmm. I chose to go into surgery because, you know, coming out of Mount Sinai, it was the toughest thing that you could do at the time, you know. Right. I'm sure if I was in medical school now, I probably would do interventional radiology because it's like, oh, you know, the toughest thing that you could do right now, right?
Exactly.
Wow.
So if you're like, you know, trying to do something and someone pulled my coat and said, you know, I think that you're going to be a great surgeon and you should come to one of the toughest programs in America, which at the time was the MCV, Medical College of Virginia. I was one of my first mentors, Dr. Arnold Salzberg, who was a visiting professor at Sinai, really kind of said, hey, kiddo, you got great hands. You should go into surgery. So that's what I did. I followed the advice of my mentor into surgery. Nice. And I followed the advice of my mentor into interventional radiology. On his deathbed, he basically said, look, I think you should not do as I do. I gave my life to this profession. I could see that you're going to do the same. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, you know, interventional radiologists had a better lifestyle, according to him. He could not have seen that today, 27 years later, mm-hmm. that the surgeons are going home and the IR doctors are here taking care of the patients because the patients are too sick for surgery. Now we're like he thought that he was helping me out mm-hmm. By saying you should choose something else that is going to give you a little bit more life. And so I followed his advice. Into radiology and then eventually to interventional radiology.
Yeah.
Who was that mentor that gave you that pearl?
His name is Arnold Salzberg. And in fact, there's a surgery lectureship that is named after him.
Oh, wow.
It's something that we as mentees of Arnold Salzberg would say that this is a Salzbergian kind of proverb. He is a person that really I strive to be like every day. And I remember when he was alive and we would talk, he'd say, when I die, Janice, and when you die, you should make sure that your tombstone says HB, not MD, because what you care about the most is that you're a human being.
Wow.
And not so much as you're an MD, an amazing, amazing human being. I want to be like him every day.
Wow.
You know, Dr. Newsom, that really speaks to the need for balance, I think. You know, this isn't the first time I've heard that a physician has given their life to the practice and devoted everything, made major sacrifices throughout their entire career. And at the end, they maybe had wished that they spent more time with family or that they traveled more, or they did different things. So I think it's important, and I've always tried to do this, and that's to have balance. You know, you can have the greatest professional career, but you know there are other things aside from being a physician.
That's exactly
absolutely
right.
And I think that, you know, that is in stages, right? So, you know, in your early stages of trying to you know, distinguish yourself, and every one of us have our own career paths and how we get there. I tell people that it's a windy road ahead of 99 miles of lots of curves. But like the Chinese proverb says, is that, you know, it's not that you're going fast or slow. You just need to make sure that you're not standing still.
There
exactly.
you go.
It's a marathon.
Exactly. Just moving in the right direction. So I'm fortunate and blessed. I'm honored. I feel privileged to be in the profession that I am right now, and I do not ever take it for granted.
Wow, that's absolutely great. A proper perspective. I mean, because that's going to give you know, you'll be able to get what you need to get from your career, but then also, you know, hopefully be able to get what you can, like, outside of, you know, medicine, because that's important too, that balance, like Travis was saying, because the balance will make you a better physician when you are, you know, working, so... You know, like
absolutely right.
Because I feel like, you know, when we were training, you know, like a lot of people, you know, there wasn't like, you know, there wasn't any focus on mental health. There wasn't any focus on like, you know, taking care of yourself. It was just like, do what I did because I did this back in the day. And, you know, that's, you know, that just will turn into a burnout later on. So it's very, very important to, you know, just have that proper perspective on, you know, what we're doing. And, you know, when we do it the best way we can.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, so if we could, can you talk to us a little bit about what you do on a day-to-day and what you're passionate about?
So I'm an interventional radiologist. And, you know, what I do every day is that I take care of people that have complex problems and try to make it simple. I try to do, I do image-guided procedures. And the great part of my job is that I treat diseases all over the body from head to toe, and things that cover every system in the body. I happen, on my side job, I happen to be the division chief chair of interventional, division chief of interventional radiology at Emory and Emory Grady in Atlanta.
And that's your side job. Wow.
largest, you know, academic medical program in the U.S. and maybe in the world. And I also am privileged to work with some of the brightest minds here at Emory, and to be exposed to some of the best learners, I think, that there is around. To be here and to be able to participate in molding the minds of what is the largest IR training program in the U.S. is extremely humbling.
That's so amazing. Oh, I think people don't really have the perspective of how big Emory is and how much of like such a great reputation it has, especially like in the South. I think there's like a lot of East Coast bias, West Coast bias, but like, you know, people who are like in the Midwest and the South, Emory is up there. I mean, that's like a goal for everyone to like try to get to do something at Emory. So that's amazing that you've been there and you've been there and doing amazing things there. So we love that you're there, and we really appreciate everything that you're doing with the program and your side job.
And my side job.
Without a doubt. I mean, the population, the patient population that you're treating at Grady and at Emory, can you speak to some of the nuances there and, you know, some of the skill sets that you think it's important to have as an interventional radiologist in that setting?
Yeah, so, you know, it turns out that, you know, to be able to practice medicine in Atlanta, and to be able to practice in these two demographic areas. So Emory is monstrous, right? So there are six hospitals now, you know, the university hospitals and, you know, some other, you know, community hospitals, some that are closer, some that are nearer. The Grady Hospital, nearly a 1,000-bed hospital in the heart of Atlanta. The diseases that patients have, they have, right? Where patients go to get their treatment may be different. But I say that from my perspective, and I may not be answering your question right away, but I'll just tell you one thing that being in this leadership role has allowed me to be able to do is to set the temperature and the direction for how our practice works. So at the helm, our practice has these core guiding principles that we're very, very, very passionate about and we're true to, which is, if you are a patient and you're getting care from someone in our practice, then the care is the same care everywhere. That is, if you get touched by one of our faculty members or any of our trainees from Emory IR, that is, that the care that you should expect at Grady, a tertiary care catchment center hospital that predominantly treats people of color, is the same care that you should expect to get if you're at Johns Creek, which is one of the most affluent communities in the United States.
That
you get at 2 a.m. is the same care that you get at 2 p.m. Same care everywhere. And that is our goal. And so, yes, there are some differences that are not related to human beings whatsoever. Maybe related to structural things, social determinants of health, how people's insurance put them where. But regardless of that, when I see someone for fibroid disease at the university hospital versus at Grady, how they're treated and what they get from us is absolutely the same. Great care.
Wow, that's amazing.
Wonderful. Healthcare equity. Equity all day.
You got that right. And that is one of my passions, right? Figuring out how we incorporate that in our everyday life, understanding our own personal biases, what we bring to the table, but how we actually bring our superpower to bear on that. And it's not lost on me who I am and what I am. And the fact that I'm privileged to be able to take care of people that look somewhat like me. But I also understand that in that same regard, because of what I look like at times, it also creates some anxiety for folks. So I have to do a little extra, you know?
That's right. There's advantages.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. That's amazing. I mean, you know, the way that you have explained healthcare equity and your goal and the passion, I can hear it in your voice. We all need to make that effort because that's so important.
And I'll tell you that I'm not saying that it's easy. You know, I know that for people that are earlier on in their career, you know, it's more than what meets the eye. It's what my phrase is, you know, like I know that I have felt the sting of discrimination and, you know, and all throughout and even now, right? That's not going to go away. What has to go away is how we react to it and how we refuse to accept that. One, it's illegal, right? And two, if you react in a different way, then you will be doing something illegal. How can we use our influence to be sure that, you know, our experiences collectively help to raise the bar, right? How do we figure out that we hold people accountable so that we don't see this bigotry within institutions continue on so that I've been doing this for a while now, but I know that I need my residents and medical students that are underrepresented to not experience the same things that I experienced. Mm-hmm. So I'm here on a campaign to be sure that I'm doing my part to tell my story, to not wash away my troubles, to not say that it was all peaches and creams every day to become the division chief of IR, but to share the possibilities that I know exist, that we all can do that, that greatness exists in all of us. And that if you're given the opportunity, if you're planted as a seed in the right soil with enough sunshine and a little rain, which must come in order to get the type of growth that you need, that you can absolutely prosper. So I do not consider my story one of exceptionalism, although I'm will admit that I live my life to be exceptional. And when I say that, Travis, I mean that in order to be exceptional, it means that the root cause of the root word is accept. So it has to be that everybody is doing this except Janice.
Comfortable with being exceptional.
Because that's what exceptional means. If you're doing the same thing as everyone, then you're just doing the same thing as everyone. That's not exceptional.
That's right.
Right. You gotta rise above it.
That's
exactly right.
Wow.
So tell me, to become chief, what was the most difficult storm that you endured? How did you get there? If you could speak to that.
So I left my years in private practice. I was in private practice for nearly 16 years came to Emory to fulfill a promise that I made to myself and a God that I didn't even know existed, you know, as a child, that anything that I learned for sure, I would teach it. So both my biological parents were high school principals in Jamaica. And So you could say in the fact that I was born to teach.
Yes.
And that's I would teach anybody anything, right? Anything at all, medicine or not. Like if I learn how to make a mean caramel macchiato, you're in trouble. Because when I meet you, I'm going to be teaching you how to make it. You know, like, if I learn a Bible story, I'll be telling you about the story just because I know it. You know, because that's what I do. Whatever I know for sure, I'm just going to teach it. I came to be able to do that. I spent my years in private practice raising my daughters. Mm-hmm. And when it was time for me to come to academic medicine to fulfill my promise, I wanted to have tremendous impact. I knew I didn't want to be where it was cold. Again, I'm from Jamaica, so, you know, any cold climate place was out of the way.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I came to Emory just to be a part of the faculty here and to try to put that mark on the junior people coming in our field. And I didn't come to be in leadership. I didn't aspire to be the division chief. Mm-hmm. But I'll say one thing. If you're hearing me right now, whatever you're doing, you're already a leader at it. You don't actually choose to be a leader. You know, that title of what you're doing is kind of what you're doing already. And let me explain. And I like thinking of it this way. I may have borrowed this from one of my pastors years ago. If you're in love right now, dating someone, you've already decided that you're treating them well, that they're like a part of you. And then one day someone says, those things that you're doing, that is what spouses do. And then you go to some place and they say, now you're married. But it turns out the next day, you're just doing the same thing anyway. But now you have this title called a wife or a husband or a spouse. Mm-hmm. And I think of leadership in the very same way. I don't do this much differently than I was doing before I became the chief. Someone says, Janice, the fact that you think about the strategic vision of the division, where people are supposed to go, that you see problems and you try to solve them, that you find your tribe, you find another tribe, and you try to bring people together. The fact that that you're doing is called being the chief. And so that's why we will make you the chief. I never applied for this job. I don't do this job. It was not in my trajectory to be the chief. Mm-hmm. At Emory, I was doing my life, mm-hmm. and I will continue to do this life. And the opportunity came, and they say that you're doing this already. Mm-hmm. And I said, you're right. This is what I'm doing. That's called the being a chief.
That's amazing. That's exactly right. That's life. That's exactly what you said. It's like anything in life. No matter what your career is or whatever you're doing, like if you're doing it and you have the habits and you have the personality and you're actually doing the actions, then the title comes later on. But it shouldn't change what you're doing at that point.
Exactly. And it's the same thing. If there's a title, right? And it's the authority in what you're doing, right? So if you go after titles, then you're going after the wrong thing.
Exactly.
The titles come. Mm-hmm.
They do. They do. By just having that sense of responsibility, that seeing a problem and feeling obligated to solve that problem, that's leadership.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. And like that's just a decision that you made after being in private practice, and it was in Virginia for a few years.
Yeah, I was in Virginia. I did my fellowship at the Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute. I was very fortunate to be taught by some of the best in our fields.
Absolutely.
And exposed to some crazy, crazy ways of doing IR. When I say that, it's not it's not about the crazy cases, but it's just how you think and approach problems. None of the things that I trained on doing back, you know, decades ago, I'm necessarily doing now, but these were skills that I will take with me forever, right?
Absolutely.
And yeah. When I'm done, I chose to practice in Northern Virginia, had a great, great time there, and moved to the Virginia Beach area where my husband's family was concentrated, mm-hmm. and had a great time there, you know. So I would tell you that it's not just about where you practice, it's where you bring all of yourself, whether you're in private practice or in academics. My decision to come back to academics was sparked by one of my other mentors, Dr. Gary Becker, who I just saw at one SIR in a casual conversation. He said to me, you know, "Hey, Newsom, like, how many purses do you have?" And, you know, everybody knows me, I like purses. And I said, "I have a lot, you know?" And he said, "Well, how many shoes do you have?" And I just said the same thing. I'm like, "Oh, I have a lot, you know?" And he said, "Well, how many more do you need?" And I'm like, "Well, what do you mean by that, you know?" And he's "You know, like, I spent a lot of my great years giving it to you, and you're going to spend them buying more shoes and more purses?" And it hit me like a brick, you know. Yeah. It is you can cover up all of the things that you are as much as you want, but mm-hmm. the seed uh-huh. of who you are on the inside. When you peel off the outside of an apple, you get the apple seed. If you plant the apple seed, you get more apples.
Correct.
You can dress it up. You can do what you need is the right tool that knows how to cut off the outside enough that it doesn't damage the seed so that it uh-huh. can be replanted. And that's what it is when you make connections with mentors and sponsors, that they learn how to cut off the outside, expose the inside, that seed, and plant you someplace else. That way you can flourish and that there can be more seed. And
listen, you better preach. Preach on.
That's right.
You know, every now and then you get into a situation where someone chops it down the middle and destroys the seed.
You know? You do kind of that.
Yeah, it's one of those things, you know. And then just finding your right allies. You know, you have mentors, you have sponsors, and, you know, they're going to be, you know, tormentors as well. Not just everybody in your life is going to be mentors. And there's something that you learn from your tormentors as well.
Exactly.
Right. You just have to keep going. Mm-hmm. I would like to take a minute to, for a shout out to Miami Vascular and Dr. Beninati. Mm-hmm. I interviewed there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I walked the halls, and I looked down those. I looked at all the graduating class pictures, and I'm sure I looked at a picture where I would have seen you and said to myself, "Now, that's someone that looks like me. I bet I can do this too." Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you. I want to thank you for doing what you did and trailblazing in IR, mm-hmm. and just you know, being an example. So this is great.
Absolutely.
This is great.
Oh, that's exactly right. I think just, you know, sometimes, you know, just doing what you're doing is a great example as well. So, like, even for the people who are not going to get a chance to meet you, or people that are going to get a chance to, you know, see you in action, just knowing that you're doing this and, you know, the advice that you give is, like, that's just great life advice, period. So, you know, we really appreciate all of that advice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, let me ask you this, like, if there's a medical student or someone in undergrad who's having a difficult time right now, what would you tell them as a mentor?
So if you're having a difficult time right now, I know that, you know, if you're in medical school, sometimes it's hard to see the connection of what you're learning in the books for why you originally applied. In uh-huh. terms of what it is that, you know, you're trying to do in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so the practical advice I would tell them is try to find someone that is at the end for you, like someone that's doing the thing. It doesn't even have to be the exact thing,
mm-hmm.
but that thing that you want to do. And try to sprinkle some of that into your book knowledge. Not talking about, a research project or writing a paper or any of that stuff. I know, for me, for instance, when I had those troubled times, I met a gentleman that was a trauma surgeon at Kings County Hospital, and he said the same thing to me. He said, just give me a call and come by whenever you feel that this doesn't apply to your life. And it was just like once every 8 months, every 8 weeks or so, I would go to the ER and with him. A huge invigoration of why I wanted to do what I'm doing right now anyway. So that's what I would say. Find someone that helps to bring you to the end so that you can see why you're doing those 10, 12 hours of study groups, why learning those ATPs may not matter at all, but it just pushes you along because you know that you're going to make a difference in that person's life when you can put in a chest tube or sew in a catheter. These small things, it seems, but it helps to bring you along. And I would tell everyone just the same, just don't, it's such a cliche thing to say, don't give up, like, of course you're not going to give up,
Don't give
but
up.
Don't give up. Don't give up. Yes. And that there are people that are out there that are absolutely rooting for you, and that there are more people that are for you than the people that are against you.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Right.
Wow. No, that's exactly right.
You find those people that are for you and you keep it moving regardless. That's great advice. I love it.
No, that's amazing. I think, that's exactly what people need to hear right there. And, with the podcast here, if anyone wants to get a hold of us, you can always reach us on any of the socials at Reading Room Talk. We really, really appreciate you being here with us. And let me get you out of here on this last question. Are you more into a dance hall or reggae?
That's a good one.
Oh, my Lanta. Okay. So, oh, my God. Am I into dance hall or reggae? Okay. So, I'm going to answer that question by saying I'm more into reggae. But, you have to know that I'm a church girl. Like, so I grew up, I'm not even sure I really understand the difference between those two genres of music.
Oh, me neither.
But
they're
I just
both awesome.
Exactly. I just call them all like Jamaican music, dancehall and reggae. I'm into Jamaican music, and I have the same dance for the same type, right? I just go faster or slower, depending. <Right. laughs> I appreciate that culture, and I've learned to love it all.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think, and you can do all of it. You can like reggae, you can like dance hall, and you can be an interventional radiologist. You can do it all.
Absolutely. And now they have like gospel music that is dance hall and reggae.
I did see that. That was amazing. I was like, natural evolution, I guess. So
I suppose. Oh, man, this has been a ton of fun, guys, and I want to say congratulations to you and this work that you're doing. I look forward to listening. I look forward to contributing in any ways at all that I can. And thank you so much for asking me.
Oh no, thank you. And
you're
we're
welcome.
Gonna, we're
thank
gonna take you up on
coming.
All those offers.
Absolutely.
So we really appreciate it. Thank you guys so much for listening. And until next time, stay low and keep firing.
Keep firing.